So for the next 8-9 weeks or so, to through the end of the year, we're going to be looking at the book of Isaiah. We're not going to do the entire book. We're just one chapter, 66 chapters in this book, so we're not going to get a chance to go through every single chapter, every single story. But as we look at the book of Isaiah, and as we read through it, you'll hear many familiar passages, many iconic images, things that draw your attention, even if you're not familiar where they come from. So the lying, laying down with the Lamb, and the wonderful counsel, the mighty God, the everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, these songs we sing at Christmas time. We'll hear of the suffering servant, of being risen up like on wings of eagles. So Isaiah is this fantastic poet. In fact, some describe the book of Isaiah as the fifth gospel. There's another way to tell the story, because Isaiah tells this amazing story of who God is. And so it's worth seeing some of these highlights, some of these high points of this incredible book. So who was Isaiah? Isaiah was a prophet. Prophets were these men and women who were called by God to speak and to share his word. Oftentimes what they did was not so much foretell the future, although that was part of it. Part of what they did was to communicate to the people of God what God had called them to do. In some ways, the prophets were like giant post-it notes. They were big reminders to say, remember what God said. Remember these promises of what God said would happen if you didn't listen to him. And so Isaiah is speaking to the people of Israel. And roughly 730 to 700 BC. So what's going on in the world? So at this time, the nation of Israel is divided into two parts. And this is where it always gets confusing. So God had called a special people, the people of Israel. They had 12 tribes. And at one point in their history, they split into two nations. 10 nations in the north and 2 nations in the south. The northern nation is called Israel, and the southern is Judah. And so it gets confusing sometimes when you're reading in the Bible, particularly in the prophets, because when they talk about Israel, sometimes you're not sure if they're referring to Israel, just the 10 northern tribes, or Israel as the whole nation. So Isaiah is speaking to this divided kingdom. He's talking to them and he's sharing these things. So we have a distance in time, but the prophetic books are sometimes hard to read. And they're hard to read for a couple reasons. One, if you have your Bible and you are following along, you notice it's not written out as a narrative. It's written in poetry form. And poetry is filled with metaphors, with images, with allegories, with all kinds of things. And so sometimes we're reading and we're not sure really what's going on, what the images are referring to, partly because of the distance in time, sometimes a difference in language, difference in culture. And so we're reading and we're not sure what's happening. But I think the other reason the prophets are hard for us to read is they just seem angry all the time. I read the prophets, and I think of my high school football coach, Mr. Tuttle. And Mr. Tuttle had two ways of addressing us as players, loud and louder. And it seemed like no matter what we were doing, he was screaming at us. He was yelling. Even when things were going great, even when we were up 34 to nothing, he was screaming and yelling. He had a clipboard that he kept plays and information on. But the clipboard, I don't think, was so much for keeping information as a motivational tool. He would use it to encourage players who were getting ready to go on the field with a quick smack of the clipboard. Hopefully you were wearing your helmet at the time. Or if you weren't close, you began to learn as a freshman, don't stand too close to Mr. Tuttle because you want to stay out of arm reach of the clipboard. But you also learned by the middle of the season that it didn't matter because sometimes the clipboard left his hand. And that's what the prophets feel like sometimes. They feel like a Mr. Tuttle who just are always angry. If you were listening to the scripture that was just read, is this a happy verse? I mean, is this the stuff you go home and say, wow, that sounds like a light verse. I'm going to put up my refrigerator. Like in that day, and if one looks at the land, there is only darkness and distress. Even the sun will be darkened by clouds. Praise God. I mean, that's not the kind of thing that's encouraging. So you read the prophets, and it can be discouraging. It can be disheartening. It can feel like just beating down. But that's why we have to also realize that this story that Isaiah tells it's not just this verse. And we sit in church and we read a chapter or two or a couple verses, and we have to pay attention because it's part of a much bigger story. And as we read the book of Isaiah, it goes back and forth. There's a lot of judgment in the book of Isaiah. There's a whole lot of doom and destruction and fire and burning. But there is also glimmers of hope. There are also these glimmers of hope. And so I want to, as we read through these things, pay attention. Where are those glimmers of hope? Because Isaiah's message isn't simply one of destruction, but it's also a message of hope. I mean, it certainly doesn't start that way. If you were to flip back to chapter 1, I mean, it starts off, the vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw. And then in verse 4, woe to the sinful nation, a people whose guilt is great. And that's about how it continues for the first 5 chapters. Although there are a few little passages in there again where we start to see a glimpse of something different, that God is going to be doing something different. Well, let's turn to chapter 5. So there's this song of the vineyard. And so Isaiah describes this picture of someone clearing a vineyard. And clearing a vineyard in those days was hard, hard work. It might take up to 3 years to get yourself a vineyard going. You'd spend the first year, you're digging up the ground, you're removing all the rocks and piling those out so you have some ground to plant your vineyard. In the second year, you're buying, you're going out and getting some choice vines, you're finding those vines that will live and thrive, and you're planting those, and then you're taking all those rocks that you dug up, and you're building a wall around your vineyard because animals might come in or thieves might come in, so you're keeping out the two-legged and the four-legged thieves out of the vineyard. You're building a watchtower, building all those things, and then finally by year 3, you're starting to see something out of it. Isaiah describes this. He says, imagine someone who's done that and has picked the choicest. He dug it up and cleared his stones and planted the choicest vines. He didn't go and get the clearance section at Menards where the vines are all great. I mean, he went down and bought the best he could. And then he planted those and got fine dirt and packed around them and waited. And those of you who are gardeners have had this experience where you go and you do all the work. And what do you expect at the end of the year? You expect something, right? You expect to go out there and find some fruit on your vines, and to find some vegetables, to find some fruit. Are you a little disappointed when it doesn't happen? Yeah. And that's what this story, this song says here. He did all this work, and then he comes out, and the NIV, the translation, is bad fruit. I think a better way is like stinky fruit. It's rotten fruit. I mean, it's not just that the grapes are small. They're ones you can't even eat. They're rotting on the vines. And so in this story, in this song, the owner of the vineyard looks and says, what is going on here? I should have gotten good fruit. I did everything right. I provided you. You had all the best, everything you could, and nothing came of it. And therefore, I'm going to tear down the walls. If thieves want to come in and destroy you, I'm going to let that happen. If the animals want to come in and destroy that, if fire wants to come in, I'm going to let it all happen and destroy. And so everyone listening to the story is thinking, oh, absolutely. That's what I do with a bad vineyard. And then the tables are turned and flipped. It says, the vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. All of a sudden, we get what Isaiah is saying. What Isaiah is saying is God has given to his people everything they need. He's brought them into this incredible land. He's given them hope. He's given them kings. He's done all that he could for them. And the expectation was, because of all that God has done, that they would be a light to the nations. That they would live in justice and righteousness. And those are the words that he used. He looked for justice but saw bloodshed, for righteousness but heard cries of distress. And so these two words, as we go through the book of Isaiah and most of the prophets, are words that show up again and again, justice and righteousness. So the Hebrew word for justice is mishpah, and righteousness is tzedek. And so these words are pictures of the way things are supposed to be. For us, justice sometimes is simply that what happens after a crime is done, right? So somebody goes and they commit a crime and then they get justice. But God's picture of justice is far bigger than that. It's a picture of the way things are supposed to be. And so God is looking for the world to be right, and he's looking for his people, the people that he's called, to be doing things that are blessing people. He's looking for them to love him and to love others, but that's not what he's seeing. And he's saying the consequence of that is they're going to be destroyed. And so we saw in verses 8 through 30, we're not going to go through every single one of those, saw pictures of the opposite of what justice and righteousness look like. First one, there in Isaiah 5. Verse 8, woe to those who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left and you can live alone in the land. He's saying, there are those of you who you are so consumed with having more. You keep adding on and building up and all of a sudden it comes to the point where you're alone. And you're not paying attention to your neighbor because you're so intent on accumulating property. And God had given them all kinds of laws and rules about how much property they were supposed to own and not owning so much and making sure that every few years some of the property got given back to people, because in those days, property was your livelihood. If you didn't have land, you didn't have a place to plant a crop. If you didn't have a place to plant a crop, you didn't have food. There were no Meijer. There was no Walmart. There was no farmer's market per se. Most of it was living on your own. And so he's painting this picture saying, woe to you. And he's like, how many of you have used the word woe anytime in the past couple of years, like in the midst of, these are not normal. These are prophet words. Woe, like bad stuff is happening to you. This is really bad. Don't do this. He's saying woe to you. In other words, bad stuff is going to happen to you because of what you've done. Woe to you, accumulated and gathered all these things, focusing only on yourself. He said, woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they are aflame with wine. He's concerned with their drinking, but more than that, he says they have no regards for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of his hands. In other words, they don't care what God's doing. They have no desire to pay any attention to it. They're so focused on themselves and indulging their own desires that they're not paying attention to what God is doing. And then it gets worse. He says, woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness as with cart ropes. Imagine the picture here that Isaiah's drawing is this picture of, here's this big wagon load of sin, and these people have just hitched a rope to it, and they're saying, come on, sin. And they're pulling it along. This is how bad they've gotten. They've gotten to the point where they're saying, oh, let God hurry, let him hasten his work. In other words, like, I'm going to do this bad stuff. Let's see if God will do anything about it. They're continuing to go down and basically daring God, challenging God, taunting God and saying, look at me. I got a big old wagon load of bad stuff I'm doing. I got a big old cart load of sin and I'm just hauling it along in these ropes. What are you going to do about it, God? Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. It's gotten to the point where these people of God, God's people who are supposed to be the light of the world, who are supposed to be shining light into the world, are basically saying, no, that's not bad anymore. I know, God, that you said that was sin, but we're going to say it's okay. And so we start to hear these things written 2,700 years ago and start to say, does any of this sound familiar? Does any of this sound familiar? And not simply for the people out there, which is the temptation of the church. Because remember when Isaiah's prophesying here, when he's speaking, who's he speaking to? The people of God. He's not pointing to the world. He's not pointing to Assyria, the big kingdom that's sitting out there, the world power of the day, who was incredibly evil and did all sorts of horrible things. He's not pointing to them and saying, look at how bad they are. He's looking to the people of God and he's saying, this is what I'm seeing in you. You who were my precious vineyard. You who I planted. You who I loved. You who I cultivated and tendered and did so much for so that you could shine and produce good fruit. Look at you. Look at what you've become. And he goes through several more woes like that. And then God ultimately says, because of that, he said he lifts up a banner for the distant nations. He whistles for those at the end of the earth. God looks and looks at his people and he's saying, you're not doing what you're supposed to do. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call the nations of the world. I'm going to say, come on, here's my people, come and get them. Just like he tore down the walls of the vineyard so that the animals and the thieves could come in. He says, I'm not going to keep my protection over God, my people anymore. I'm not going to protect them anymore, but instead I'm going to invite the nations to come. And that's exactly what happens. And that's the story of Isaiah. Is there this, as we go, chapters 1 through 39, the book roughly divides at about 1 through 39 and then 40 through 66. The first part of it is all this talk of, if you're not listening, something bad is going to happen. People of God, you need to listen up. Always with little glimmers of hope, but in the midst of it, you are going to be punished. And the way God punishes his people is by withdrawing his protection. He steps back and he lets the foreign enemies come. And ultimately, in 721 BC, the people of Assyria, the kingdom of Assyria, comes in, conquers the northern kingdom, and takes them off into exile. And so that's the language that's often used for God's people, is to go into exile. Because to go into exile is to be apart from the temple. To go into exile is to be apart from the land that was promised. To go into exile is to be away from the presence of God. And so God is saying, because you are not listening, because of what you're doing, this is what's going to happen. And so we hear this and we say, okay, what about us today? We're not the people of Israel. But the call is the same. The call is the same to live lives of justice and righteousness. The call is the same to bear good fruit. But I think as we pay attention to the story, we say, okay, how do we do that? Where do we do that? And it's one thing, and our temptation is, especially as Americans, is kind of pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. Kind of say, we just got to work a little bit harder. And it would be easy for me as a pastor, as a preacher, to kind of stand up here and play prophet, to play Mr. Tuttle and just kind of wave my Bible around instead of my clipboard to tell you you all need to be better. To say you're not doing what you're supposed to, you're not taking care of the poor. Look at that box out there. There's only three coats out there. I mean, to get and say, this is not justice, this is not righteousness. God's looking for this, and look at you, you're a sham. How long would that last? Not long. We say, then how do we do this? And where's the hope in the midst of this? What do we do with this if we're called to live justice and righteousness? Because I think that call is still the same for us. To live in justice and righteousness, and the way Jesus framed it was to love your neighbor as yourself. To care for those on the outside. So how do we begin to do it? Where does it come from? And I think what we learn is from the words of Jesus. Because in the Gospel of John, Jesus said this, I am the true vine. Jesus said, I am the true vine. I think Jesus intentionally takes this image from Isaiah. And he says, I am the true vine, meaning what? He's the one who did all that. He's the one who lived up to what God's call is. But then he goes on and he says, he cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit. Well, every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes. He says, remain in me as I also remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. In other words, the call for us is to do the same, but it's not by working ourselves up. It's not by beating ourselves up. It's not by trying a little bit harder. But the way to bear the fruit of righteousness and justice is through the vine. It's through staying attached to Jesus. Recognizing that only in relationship with him, only through the power of his Spirit living inside of us, can we be that kind of people. That's the way we can live out this life of love, to remain connected to Jesus. And that's the heart of the message, to say, God calls us to remain connected. And we remain connected to him. But there's another part of the story that I think we learn as we think about the story of Jesus. Remember the story of Isaiah. begins with this vineyard that didn't bear fruit. What happens? The owner of the vineyard tears down the walls and does this. And in some sense, I can almost imagine the vineyard, the gardener coming in and with his hands ripping up those old vines that weren't bearing fruit. I don't know if you've ever worked in vineyards. I mean, vines, they're nasty. You can imagine him grabbing those vineyards, those vines, and ripping them and bloodying his hands as he's pulling up the old vines, the useless vines, casting them into the fire and saying, I can't, they're not producing fruit. But then we move forward to Jesus. And Jesus was the true vine, the vine that produced that fruit. Yet, what happens to Jesus? Jesus is the one who suffers and dies. We see Jesus whose hands and feet are bloodied. The true vine, the one that produced righteousness and goodness, the one that bore fruit, dies on a cross. And he dies on a cross so that we who live in him then might bear fruit. So that we might have that. And so the story comes full circle. So even in the midst of this story of Isaiah where it seems like there's no hope, where it seems like, how can we ever produce good fruit? God says, I'm going to send someone and I'm going to show you what good fruit looks like. And then that good fruit, that good vine, the true vine is going to die. And then I'm going to raise him again from the dead so that you might live in him and you might bear fruit. So this story comes round. He says, this is what it looks like. And that's where the hope is. That Jesus is the one who ultimately comes and brings us out of exile. That the punishment, the justice, because we all realize, we can look back on our lives and say, I haven't done all that. I mean, there have been the times where I called evil good and good evil. There have been the times in my life where I have attached a rope to the wagon of sin and pulled it closer to me. There have been the times where I have been ignoring what God has had to say. There have been the times where I've been so focused on accumulating, I've been ignoring my neighbors. And because of all that, God has every right to send us into exile. God has every right to withdraw his protecting hand and allow us to suffer the consequences. But Jesus comes and takes the consequences for us. Jesus comes and dies that we might have life, life eternal. Jesus comes and dies so that we can be a part of the vine and bear fruit. And so even as we come to the communion table, that's part of what we remember. We remember a body that was broken and blood that was shed. And as we take in that bread and that cup, we're reminded of Jesus, who is the true vine. The one who gives us life so that we can bear good fruit. And so may we know the Jesus, the true vine, who died so that we might live. Jesus, the true vine, that died so that we might bear fruit. And as we remain attached to Jesus, as we remain connected to him, may we bear fruits of justice and righteousness.